Hi, this is Doug. Welcome. How's everybody doing?
Doing great.
Super. Want to bring us up to date about anything that's going on for you, any wins or progress notes?
Dave, this is Terry. No wins or progress notes. I have a nasty cold. Does that count?
Ah, okay. Well, that kind of gets you off the hook.
Yeah. Nice.
Okay. So, you know, how is your practice going?
My practice, I just sent out this morning a new campaign, a new coaching campaign. Very excited, getting some good response. No new clients yet, but I'm totally confident and excited about that.
What kind of focus are you having with the new campaign coaching?
So I am really focusing on people that are in transition. So that would be kind of my main focus areas are people who are inheriting wealth and that kind of identity transition. People my age, I'm 55, it seems everybody I know is going through job transitions.
Yeah.
And exiting athletes, I'm pretty passionate about.
And how are you doing your marketing? What are you focusing on, and how are you going about that?
Well, so what we did this, so a lot of what I have done is positioning myself with a group called the Purposeful Planning Institute, which is a nationwide group of philanthropists, wealth advisors, some people like myself, financial advisors, lawyers, estate planners who really focus on helping, facilitating a legacy that doesn't just include money, a legacy that includes the social capital and the personal capital and the intellectual capital.
Uh-huh.
So done a lot with positioning myself and educating myself with these people. And then marketing to clients and people who have referred me clients in the past.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
Any new ideas?
Well, it sounds like a terrific focus. I would think about who are the gatekeepers for your ideal clients. And where are you going to cross paths with these gatekeepers? It sounds like you have some good inroads for that, you know, the Purposeful Planning Institute and that sort of thing. But look at where your gatekeepers reside, people who have access to portals of people who are your ideal clients. Are they financial planners? Do you need to present, say, to a community foundation meeting? You know, the consortium of people who have a community foundation manage the individual family foundations that are small enough, like 1 to 20 million, that they don't have their own administrators. You know, think about where the people are who are your referral sources, who are the gatekeepers who you can let know and educate about what you do that will really garner your clients and your focus in that way, to have them be your adversary, to have them be an ally in terms of referrals.
Right. And I'm always thinking about the gatekeepers, and they are often estate planners and financial planners.
Uh-huh.
Absolutely. Yep.
Uh-huh.
But I hadn't thought about community foundations for kind of smaller, 1 to 20 million. That's a great idea.
Yeah, I did a presentation actually for the Colorado Community Foundation about a year and a half ago, and there were 600 people. And
wow.
It was an amazing group. They manage and oversee what the foundations want people to invest in, and if they don't have a direction, they'll look at and research and make recommendations, and they have a huge amount of capital that they're administering, and they're a wonderful group of people. They're in Fort Collins, and it was a terrific experience, which is where Chris Osborne. So, I mean, just it opened my awareness to things like that and to access to various nonprofits, if that's the direction and an interest that you're going.
Yep, that's a great idea.
Okay. Well, who else wants to check in and or bring up anything to discuss?
Hey, Dave, this is Jen.
Hey, welcome. How are you?
Good, thank you. I have a new client that is, I really have just been so chomping at the bit to ask you about. She's an executive in a high power position, and she's having not enoughness issues.
Not enoughness.
She feels like she doesn't deserve where she is, and that she thinks it's a big fluke that she has the success that she is, and she doesn't feel like she's enough or has earned the position that she's in, among other things, which I won't go into. However, I know that there's a story there, right? So, of course, like, it's on the top of my mind, you know, like, what is the story? And the story comes from her past, her culture, her ethnicity, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like on the cusp of just, I know that there's something I'm not doing, you know, to help her. I don't know, like, what's my step?
Okay.
What's my step?
Okay. What is it you feel she's right on the cusp of, or that you together with her are right on the cusp of?
Of identifying we've identified that the story is from her youth, right, her past, and that is not necessarily true in her present, because she has a list of accomplishments that outwardly shows that she is very worthy of the
right.
position, but yet the story still lingers.
Okay.
And so what we're on the cusp of is determining, and that I don't know how to get her there, is to, I don't know, like help her realize that it's that there's another story to be told, you know, that there's a true story now for her.
Okay.
That isn't that old story.
Okay. Here's what I'm hearing. I think the model that you and she may have in mind, even though you haven't stated it, is
mm-hmm.
a topographical model. That here's things on the surface. And then here's what's right below that from the past and from the old experiences and the material
mm-hmm.
that comes from transference from other people and whatever
yep.
the content is. Now, consider a different model.
Okay.
Consider a vertical model.
Mm-hmm.
Consider that her story is quite adequate, in fact, superlative for her success when she is in the present. Now, the key, I believe, from what you're saying, is the instant that she gets a cue or a trigger, which is either internal or external, but whenever there's a cue or trigger, she instantly changes her state of mind and boots up an old state.
Yeah.
So maybe the first thing I might ask her is when you're experiencing your competence and really feeling your success, all the things that you've done to get to your position,
mm-hmm.
what are you aware of that really flips a switch? What kind of cue or trigger are you aware of that changes your own conversation internally?
Mm-hmm.
Now, she probably won't be aware of a cue or trigger, but there's some kind of signal anxiety that she has there that triggers a switch to a different state of mind. So the second question I would ask her is, when you're feeling like you're not good enough and they're going to find out you're a fraud, whatever the content is, what's the age of that conversation? In other words, how old does she feel inside at that conversation? And let's say the last person I did this was a very accomplished professional, very much like her, and I asked her that question, and she said, 16. And she said, oh. And I said, in that instant, it takes only a nanosecond to move from you're experiencing yourself with all the competence and success that got you there, and then there's a cue or trigger that's state changing, and all the material from that old state is in place. It's like booting up an entire software program.
Yeah,
It contains all of that material, and once you're inside it, you can't reason or logic your way out of it. There's no way to understand the dynamics of it and the meaning and the symbolism. That's all bullshit. That's not going to make any difference because you can't logic or reason your way out of it. You have to get back centered and grounded and then look at what the cue or trigger was in order to recondition that. Look at the four chart, the four column chart, remember? Mm-hmm. That I sent around?
I do.
Okay.
I do.
Get her
I
to
do.
Fill that out and look at what are the cues or the triggers that move her instantly into that second column, which is all of the negative or disparaging things or the way she feels incompetent or less than or whatever, all the things, and look at all the triggers. Get her, for example, to recommend to her, I would suggest, that she schedule a brainstorming session with herself and that she get very present, very centered for that brainstorming session. Make it a 30-minute maybe or 40-minute time. Whatever it is, it's an appointment with herself to really reflect and brainstorm. No interruptions. She keeps it with the same loyalty that she would an appointment with a doc or an attorney. And think about all the triggers that will cue her to move into that state, that way of feeling. So, in other words, that first appointment with herself, fill out columns 1 and column 2. Not by getting in that state again, because it's a blind alley. You can't get out of it once you're in it, but to reflect on it, to stay observant and look at the cues or the triggers, and for each cue or trigger, what the response is, the reactive response, which is state-changing, because between walk column 1 and column 2, in that thin vertical line, that's where that's the state change. So the idea is to cue her radar for all the things that are triggers, emotional triggers or cues to create that state change and what all the specific aspects are of that state change, because the content is what she's responding to and trying to understand and trying to reason or logic herself out of it, and that it doesn't work that way. Now, a second appointment with herself, and I think this needs to be a second time because it's a different state of mind to figure that out. Look at how she wants to work at getting grounded, and I would suggest looking at that for the mantra, which is the combination of the cue and the focus and the physiology. We're going to talk about this in the seminar on states of mind, so we're like one or two away from that. So it's going to make sense then. But look at my blog on mantras. It's like the second or third in the archived blogs on the right.
Okay.
Would you like me to send you a copy of it so you can give her a copy of it and send you another copy of that four-column thing?
I would. I'm looking for that four-column. I can't find it.
Okay. Let me.
That would be
let
great.
Me do that. I'll do that for everybody. The
Thank
four
you.
Four-column plus the mantra. Yeah. And the mantra will give an idea, a very quick way of getting grounded and centered, which is the third column, and then to move to an ideal state. And I'm sorry, an ideal behavior. The second column is behavior. And the fourth column is an ideal behavior. So what the process is, if you track one cue and what resultant or reactive behavior there is across then to get grounded and centered and what an ideal behavior is, that is going to be the new story, because someone then can reprogram their mind and brain to use that cue or that trigger for an ideal response so that they don't have to avoid something from now on.
And I believe
this is the best way to handle success phobia or imposter syndrome or all the things that, because I'll bet instantly when you ask her what is the age of that conversation, how old do you feel inside, she's going to instantly have some lights go off and say, oh, man, 14 or, whatever it is. because it's not going to be whatever her age is now.
And then where do you take that? So, okay, so she has this realization.
Okay, you be her and I'll be you.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay.
So, when you feel like you are going to be discovered, that you're an imposter or that you don't feel adequate,
mm-hmm.
what is the age of that conversation? How old do you feel inside?
Well, I feel about 12.
Are you aware of what triggered or cued that instant change from competent, successful adult woman to suddenly being 12?
Okay, so it was when he told me that I wasn't any good up there on the speaking platform. He was criticizing my presentation, my boss. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, then, yeah, that's his self-statement. There's something going on with him that he's needing to put her down. But anyhow, I wouldn't get into that. But then I would look with her at figuring out a way to use that cue or that trigger to
mm-hmm.
create a way to get centered instead of going back to 12. You know, so, you know, another possibility is to say, well, it must not feel fair then that you send a 12-year-old out to deal with very adult things.
Mm-hmm, 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 mm-hmm.
So that's going to perpetuate that feeling and make it seem even worse. That's not
mm-hmm.
fair.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Just to have her recognize that and be
yes.
aware.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Okay.
Because
yeah.
she's instantly... transporting herself to an old story, one that
right.
no longer fits, and one that
right.
is not appropriate for the current context. So she's going to live into that, and if she responds as 12, it's going to validate the assumption that she doesn't have what it takes.
Yeah, maybe I could ask her how a 43-year-old would respond. So it's a 12-year-old response, right? So maybe I could ask her how a 43-year-old would respond.
That would be the fourth column. How ideally would you like to respond?
Oh. Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And then let's figure out a way that you can use that cue or that trigger to instantly recognize what has happened in the past to get instead grounded and centered to then substitute that ideal response.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are going to be other triggers like that. That's not going to be the only one. They're going to
That's
be
right.
Some of them may come from him. Some of them may come from other people. Some of them may be her own generation. But each of the cues or triggers and the response to each
mm-hmm.
need to be their own line and all the way across to develop an ideal behavior or response. And the mantra probably can be the same for all, because once you get an effective mantra, it's going to work.
I like it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I need this, yeah. That's really good. Thank you, Dave.
Super.
Really helpful.
Yeah, give us a report back and see how it works.
Will do.
Okay. Okay, great. Thanks for bringing
Thank
it
you.
up.
Thank you so much.
Look at applying some of this
yeah.
stuff and see if it works.
Yeah, no,
yeah.
I'm certain it will.
Well, who else wants to check in and what would you like to talk about?
Hi, Dave. Hello.
Hi. Welcome. Go ahead.
This is Lalia.
Welcome. Hey.
I'm back from my trip.
Great. Welcome back.
Sort of barely awake. But I actually didn't have a chance because I just recently got back. So I didn't have a chance to listen to the recording of last week. So I hope I will get to catch up on what you covered.
Okay.
On what I missed. But something that we talked about 2 weeks ago just kept coming back to me as I was going through my own personal experiences on my trip and also as well as with a coaching client that I had a session with prior to my leaving. And that was this high idea of how one influences somebody else, and how do you coach somebody to do that? Because in effect, you really, you can only change yourself and your state and how you want to be in whatever setting or relationship. But the problem is somebody else's behavior or their response and getting the response that you want. In this case with my client, she wanted to go to her boss to ask for a change in her schedule. She wanted to move on to develop another career, and she wanted to have time to do that. And she was nervous that she would just be rejected. She would just get a no. And so that brought up this whole question in my head is, what, you know, it's one thing to coach yourself in your own state. It's another when the issue is how do you influence somebody else? And how do you coach somebody to think about the influence they have on somebody else? So I would love to hear your thoughts on that.
Okay. Well, that's a really good question, because it's about a couple of things. One is your own commitment to yourself. The most common difference between the best and everyone else is a compelling reason. Somebody who's committed to something, somebody who knows their why.
Mm-hmm.
And meaning comes from contributions, something you believe
right.
in that makes a difference.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a major component. Now, the remainder is about the science of persuasion.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, from there are two forces of motivation that drive all human behavior: the desire to avoid pain and the desire to seek pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody is not doing something they want to do or need to do or feel that would be in their best interest, and it doesn't make any logical sense whatsoever that they're not doing it, find out what the pain is that they associate with it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the basic motivator. They're avoiding something that's painful.
Mm-hmm.
So look then at the negative, at the positive consequences if they do it, and the negative consequences if they don't. In other words, they need to associate more pleasure with doing it than not doing it. They need to really look at the consequences of the pain. People will do more to avoid pain than to seek pleasure. It's from behavioral economics, risk aversion. That we have twice as much pain at losing $100 than we do pleasure at making $100. So look at how they can substitute a greater pleasure with doing it. So let me give you a common example. Somebody wants to generate more income and create wealth, and they have a plan to do it. They're just not putting it into play.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't understand why. Well, there's some shadow story that's going the opposite direction that's associated with pain. And that may be, I don't really think I have what it takes, or I don't know if I do all that work, how it's going to turn out, or I don't think I really deserve wealth, or having money is unspiritual. There are any number of stories that can go into that for the shadow story that goes the opposite direction that can make the pain make sense. So it has to be compelling and real, and not doing it has to be associated with pain. Now, think about when people do something, when people buy something, they buy emotionally and justify logically. So she may be avoiding this emotionally, but she's going to find logical ways to avoid it and to make sense that she's avoiding it. So what you have to do is to perturbate her system, challenge her, to find, to disturb that system, because it, as it stands, she's going to be stuck. So the main thing, the primary thing that determines how someone is going to respond is their state of mind. Whatever we associate something to determines our behavior, and our state of mind determines the meaning we attach to something. So if she attaches some meaning that she's going to be refused or whatever, then it's going to make sense not to do it. But anything like that makes sense. Well, you know, I'm not going to submit my manuscript to an agent because it might not make the New York Times bestsellerist. Well, you know, you spent your whole life not having something on the New York Times bestseller list. If you submit it and you don't make it, you know, so what? You know, you've been doing that all your life. What's the real problem here? So the motivator and the opposing force is all emotional. So the state of mind that she's in is going to determine whether she's going to proceed. So, and this is the key of everything we do in coaching, and the key of what a client does and how they proceed is management of states of mind. Managing the state of mind, because the state of mind is going to determine the meaning she attaches, and the meaning she attaches is going to determine the behavior. Like in the last example, you know, she suddenly becomes 14. And from that state, it looks like, which is an absolutely accurate perception from that state, that she's not going to be able to do the kind of executive premier performance and optimizing performance that a 43-year-old, very accomplished woman is going to do. So that's an accurate perception from that state of mind. That's true. And that's why you can't reason or logic your way there, because from 14 years old, you're not going to get to a logical place of saying, well, like, I think I can handle it as if I'm 43. It doesn't work that way. She has to get back to her state where she has full access to the information that she has and the capacity that she has at 43. So I would suggest thinking about what she is doing in a similar way to get her to a state of mind that she goes in and request what she's worth. Confidence is a state of mind. Getting her to that state and having her sustain that state is, I believe, the most important thing that she can do.
Right, and we definitely worked on that. I mean, she was absolutely...
When you say worked on that, tell me what you did.
I asked her what kind of behavior, what state, in effect, she would be in when she would be the most effective in talking to her.
And you used the term state.
I think it was just how she saw herself.
Yeah.
You know,
see, people are not accustomed to thinking in states of mind because that's a systemic way of thinking. We're used to thinking in a linear way. We're used to thinking in a topographical way. But in a systemic way, you know, to think about a state of mind is awfully hard to do until you really use an example and make it real, like, you know, how old did you feel, or what was the age of that conversation?
Yeah, right.
That really crystallizes the awareness of it, mm-hmm. because most people don't have the experience of really thinking about their mind and how it works in a systemic way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's just not a way we're trained to do. So, see if working on her state and getting her mm-hmm. into a confident state of mind and sustaining that throughout can be, because she's going to teach him how to respond to her.
Right.
If she goes in a confident way, you know, she's going to get what she wants. If she teaches him to respond to her as if she's undeserving or uncertain, he will absolutely follow suit.
Right.
So she has to get in a confident state and sustain it.
Right. Yeah, that's great. Thanks. Yeah.
Let's see what happens, because I think we probably need to work on that one a little bit more.
Yes. Okay. That sounds great.
Okay.
Thanks.
All right. Great. Just briefly, anybody else want to check in? Because we need to move into our material. Tisha?
Hello. How are you?
Welcome. How are you? What's going on?
I'm good. I really don't have anything to contribute in terms of client relationships, but I did have a question, but I feel like it might be a longer conversation. I know you want to get into the material, so.
Well, go ahead and ask, and we can get started, and I can be uncharacteristically succinct, possibly.
Okay. One question. I've been kind of listening through some of the recordings over the weekend, and just sort of refreshing, reminding myself. and reading some of the material, and there's a theme that that's coming up for me, which is the notion of, I think it's what I was trying to get at last week when I asked the question, but the notion of creating our, and not just co-creating in terms of creating with our client, but if we were coaching a client on creating their present, their future, creating their story, what's the balance of the co-creation part? And I think the person who just asked the question before about how do we influence, you know, for example, someone else's reactions or responses to you, or do we, kind of ties to this. But I'm having a hard time trying to find that balance of, yes, we are as individuals creating our life, our kind of our moment to moment with what we think and how we respond. But there are others around us that are also, you know, contributing to our current events, sort of the event response piece that you talked about, but that are co-creating some of the events. And so I guess that's where the response comes in. But I guess, you know, how much of it is really truly about our own.
Okay, let me try to focus the question that I can address. Are you talking about the coach-client relationship and the co-creation, or are you talking about the client co-creating with other people in their lives?
Client co-creating with other people in their lives?
Okay. Well, as Einstein talked about, we're an energy field, and we interact with the energy field of another and of others. So there is a co-creation and a synergy of experience. Now, in terms of someone's own story and how purely they're creating that, there are all kinds of interactions, and how you manage those interactions and how you manage the assumptions of those interactions are going to be important, because you choose the people you're around. First of all, You are the casting director of everyone in your life. So you're choosing those people. You know, are they working well? Do they have the values that you want? Are they enhancing your life? Because remember, everything you experience in adulthood, you either create or you agree to. So if someone is agreeing to being around someone or doing something they don't want to do, then it may be time to reexamine that. And if there's a payoff, they need to decide, is it worth the emotional or the other kind of expense? So while it's a co-creation, part of the work that we may do with certain clients is to recognize that all someone can do is to write their own story and to let go and give up the expectation that you can get someone else to respond in exactly the right way, and that how someone responds needs to not have a determination over your well-being or your success, or you need to re-examine if the price you're paying is worth it. So you're a casting director and the producer of an entire life story. So some things may need to be examined. Now, I've had clients who have needed to examine what they needed to examine, and they've decided very consciously, you know, I know I need to leave my husband, but I am right now not willing to do that. You know, it would be too costly. I have too nice a lifestyle, and I'm willing to pay the price. And you know, I certainly accept that, and I understand that. And we look at, you know, what's the optimum story you can write given those kind of constraints, and how will you decide if you make a different decision? So, everyone is within a system, and every time you affect one component of the system, you're affecting the whole system. Now, I think we need to return to this. Does this give a beginning look at some of what you're addressing?
Yes, it does.
Does anyone else have a perspective or a take on that you'd like to add? I certainly don't want to be the only one talking or responding to questions. I know there's a lot of wisdom in this group that I'd like to really develop. Any other thoughts? Well, keep that in mind, and let's come back to that. And also keep in mind that we have six people in the class. I'd like to have one of you do the roadmap, the couple-page roadmap presentation, and devote 15 minutes of our discussion time to that, probably each of the remaining time. So if you'd like to volunteer, that'd be great. And remember, I sent you the sample. It can be on yourself. It can be on a client. We can, if you can present it in 2 or 3 minutes and in the roadmap format, then we'll have time to discuss it. And that, maybe that would, as a group discussion, be helpful to illuminate some of these things. Is there a volunteer for next time? He said nudgingly. Anyone?
No one wants to go first.
Yeah, no. Well, the sample I sent is one sample of someone who gave me permission, who trained before. So hopefully that was an example. But
so this is to report it. Like, what would it be?
Just send it around, and we'll go over it in 2 or 3 minutes, and then talk about the case and talk about if the roadmap system is helpful. We're gonna finish the last two steps today.
So would my just so I can understand, because when I saw this I wasn't exactly sure. Is it wow? Is it like
be,
that?
It could be yourself to to roadmap some aspect yourself, or one of your stories, or be for a client.
Okay. And so it would be writing it in this vein, like that you sent.
Yeah, just some kind of looking at it from the perspective of the seven steps, the roadmap, to see if that's helpful to look at it. You want to give it a shot next time, Jen?
Yeah, I'll try. That way.
Okay. Thank you. Okay.
There's no bar set yet.
Okay. Well, that's good. Yeah, I know. That's exactly the first part of, you know,
I could use. Well, could I use that client example?
Say
that
again?
I was talking about? Could
absolutely.
I use that client example?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And if you were a client, I wouldn't have to ask permission if I could coach you, but may I coach you for a minute?
Yeah.
Okay. If you were a client, I would say, I want to tell you about one of my favorite philosophers of the 20th century. He said, try not, do or do not, there is no try. That was Yoda. So instead of trying, you agree to present next week, so that's great.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I agree. Thank you.
Okay, great.
So what do you want me to do? Just email it around?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Okay, thank you. And be thinking about who wants to volunteer next. Okay? All right, I want to move into our discussion today. We're going to talk about the last two steps, author new experiences and program new identity. Now, we trust our stories. They're our reality. And remember, a client does not think of something as an old story. They don't even think about it as their story. It's just the way things are. When our stories and our behaviors don't fit, we experience disharmony. We have to change one or the other to restore that harmony. Sometimes we revise our stories. Sometimes we simply change the way we see reality. Now, you've considered if your story doesn't allow you to do certain things. If your story is that you're a procrastinator, it will disallow you from finishing early. If your story says you don't do technology well, you'll live out this assumption. So we always monitor our impact as coaches as well, what works and what doesn't, how to dose, time, and titrate our responses, how to incorporate the client's work and performance style and personality into the work, and to not respond personally to the client's stuckness or resistance. Now, as we guide clients to author new experiences, at first the idea of change will create excitement. Then, as it's on the cusp of action, anxiety, then expansion, and then finally, mastery. I want to add a couple of things to your thinking that can appear together but may seem like a paradox. This is kind of like viewing from a wide-angle lens because they're a developmental overview of writing a new story. The first is every step forward means relinquishing a past position. Someone must mourn. They must say goodbye emotionally as well as practically to a familiar, maybe long-held and practiced old story. This is a process, a developmental step, not something you can just say and make it so or recognize it and change it. It's like saying goodbye to an old friend to give up a habit or a pattern of behavior or even a hope that by getting the old story just right or doing it better will make it work. No matter how maladaptive, the old story has to be mourned. For example, each of the hundreds of young women with bulimia I worked with had to mourn her bulimia, the loyal companion it had become, being there when no one else was. To come to the end of the past, she had to say goodbye to an old friend to successfully move on and redefine her identity. Two, the more subtle aspect in learning something new and creating change is an injury to self-esteem. And when you think about it, to change is a narcissistic injury because you fashion the best response that you can think of and then suddenly to find there's something better. Because there's some aspects of identity attached to this response, and it's replaced by something better. Now, I see some components in this dynamic of change. These are not headlines. You won't see a manifestation of each of these with a client, but these are just to think about, maybe as an internal conceptual marker for us as coaches. The myth that there is a perfect choice. The illusion that the perfect choice will solve all problems. The disappointment that nothing's perfect. There isn't even an ultimate arbiter of fairness. The development, the recognition that no one's going to take care of it for you. The growth to take the next best action. And finally, the consolidation, the happy-sad experience resulting. Happy about the autonomy of moving ahead and mastery, the effectiveness of not constructing an obstacle, and sad about mourning the old story. Now, to author new experiences, sometimes you have to think out of the box. But how do you do that? What is the box even? How do you think outside it? Randall Kennedy put it this way, thinking that frees itself of reflexive obedience to familiar signals. This is one of the quotes I saw not too long ago printed on the wall of the Student Union at Princeton. How do you know when you're in the box to get out of it, to revise your story or write another one? These questions assume the story is there, a given in the universe, as if the story, the proverbial box of the familiar and accepted, is the obstacle. But it's not there until you create it or accept it. And people are always free to change their minds, their beliefs, their core assumptions. Now, the box is the result of programming and conditioning. It's self-created in adulthood. But boxes aren't a bad thing. They don't have to be limiting. They can be defining, guiding, validating, expandable. Listen to a couple of examples here, to these different boxes, to hear how very arbitrary and totally situational each one is, with its own intrinsic set of beliefs, behaviors, and rules. People treat a piece of processed leather as if it were sacred. They protect it, hide it, they try to steal it. There are all kinds of rules about what you can and can't do with it, even who can touch it or who can hold it. If it crosses an arbitrary line somebody draws, it counts for different points, +2, -2, 3, sometimes 6. Football. Another, it moves in and out of your life. It varies daily. You want more, but you may keep doing the same thing not to get it. And in fact, two people can do the very same thing and obtain massively different quantities. You can buy it or sell it, but the price changes daily, even minute by minute. It can be a stand-in for what you want, even for what you despise. And here's the lifeline clue. It's the most desired legal substance to all peoples of the world. Money. And a final one. There's no clear definition of winning. It's always at risk. There's always a price to pay. There's always another level of success. Money, your life story, your wellness story. Now, here's a footnote to those of you working with executives or owners to write the next chapter of their business stories. The box can be limiting or inflexible. The canal boat companies of the 1700s didn't become the railroad companies of the 1800s. They stuck to their box. And in the 1900s, there were no Union Pacific Airlines. They stuck to their box. Good to gone. Motorola stuck to their story and slid from a premier electronics firm to a troubled industry. Meanwhile, Nokia asked and listened to children and young people just developing their stories and used their feedback to become world class. Good to great. So, open yourself to possibilities you haven't quite imagined yet. Scarcity is a rigid box. Abundance is expandable. No one can grant you freedom. You have to declare it. No one gives you power. You have to generate it, claim it, and then not give it away. So to recognize yourself as the author, the creator of your story, challenges an assumed model and may lead to the deeper question, how do I create something else instead? And what will that something else be? To simply stop doing something is not complete change. A new story means incorporating new behavior and beliefs. You have to embody, actually live your new story. To abstain from an old story, from stuckness or repetition, is a beginning. But someone has to engage a new story before an old story can be given up. A mind that accepts a new idea generates a new dimension. A brain that creates a new experience alters its neurochemistry and neuronal pathways. Neuroscientists now know that the brain is sculpted by changes and experiences. The mind can change the brain, and it's an inside job. So here are some AAA principles of change to author a new story. And the three A's are awareness, acceptance, and action. One, you're writing your own story. Is it working? For each component, what are the results? Honestly assess each of these storylines with the question, is it working? And make that a yes or no. Your personal wellness story, mind, body, spirit. Your business career story. Your relationship story. Your money story. When I ask people what they most look forward to, what they're most afraid of for the next chapters of their lives, they often respond with vague dreams, yet specific fears. The top of the lists of long-term concerns, health and money. A not-so-secret to success is that you have to pay in full for that success. So you might as well find out what the price is, pay it in full, pay it as soon as possible, and then enjoy the benefits of success. The price is always some form of energy, whether that energy is money, time, work, or experience. If you get something for which you haven't provided value or benefit, you'll still have to pay in some way. For example, if you incur debt in order to purchase something before you've earned the money, you simply end up paying more for it. And now here's another non-secret. People who truly enjoy getting what they want are those who find a way of enjoying paying the price. I'm doing it right now. I love this. I think you're each going to make such a difference to so many lives. This makes it easy to pay. And it's not even like paying because this is my passion. The price for what you want to do is whatever you need to give in order to generate exactly what you want. Two, you're writing your own story. It takes just as much energy to create any belief in your story. Positive or negative, past, present, or future, adaptive or maladaptive, the same energy. The belief of scarcity takes just as much energy as abundance. You generate the energy and give power to your story. And here's a short list of some results when you focus on what you don't want. Fear, anxiety, anger, confusion, annoyance, helplessness, guilt. Three, you're writing your own story. Decide what you want. the primary reason most people don't get what they want is they're not quite sure what they want. Here's a neuroscience law of attraction question. How does the brain work like a travel agent? The first two questions a travel agent asks, where do you want to go? When do you want to get there? So a goal is like MapQuest. You program in where you want to go, you make a map, determine the time. Now, a caveat here is to know what not to do is at least as important as knowing what to do. You may not always know what the next right thing is, but you can almost always know what it isn't. And you resist what you draw toward you. Resistance is an engagement. It's kind of like saying anger is as passionate an attachment as love. They're both passionate attachments. One's negative, one's positive. There's kind of an example about this principle, but I love this quote. Paul Conrad, who's a political cartoonist, said of Charles Coughlin, a 1940s radio preacher, I knew that anybody who had to holler that loud could not be right. And consider this, most suffering is the result of resisting what already is. People resist going to the doctor, but they aren't afraid of doctors. They're afraid their denial is going to be confronted. 4, you're writing your own story. Do you have specific, measurable goals? In a Harvard study begun in the mid-1950s, 10 to 15% of the Harvard Business School graduates fashioned a vision and specific goals for their life and business. 5 decades later, that same 10 to 15% had 90% of the assets of the entire group. Motivation increases as soon as you're clear about the goal and the payoff. Focus enhances when you have a specific plan and strategy. And I'd suggest reviewing in the workbook the exercise 11 Steps to Ignite Success, beginning on page 3.13, and especially the SMART Goals, Initiatives, and Next Best Action. That might be particularly useful with clients. Now, it's estimated that 10% of people have measurable goals, but 100% of people have some good ideas, at least some. The difference between a good idea and a goal, measurement and time, where and when, the travel agent questions. Here's a good idea. I'd like to lose weight. Here's a goal. I will reach 185 pounds by March 31st, 2014. Here's a good idea. I want to make more money. Here's a goal. I will generate $220,000 from coaching and $215,000 from products and royalties in the next 11 months. One more. A good idea. I will save more for retirement. And here's a goal. I will set up an automatic deduction of $300 per month from my checking account to automatically deposit in my retirement fund. A good decision you only have to make once. Then write a breakthrough goal. Anything that would stretch you, bring incredible opportunities, move you to a higher level, a quantum leap, getting a book on a New York Times bestseller list, spending every March skiing in Steamboat Springs, and every August riding on the coast of Maine. Now, you guys are going to have to substitute your own goals there. Then reread your goals, regular and breakthrough, twice a day, when you wake up and when you go to bed. 5, you're writing your own story. Small changes lead to big changes. Issues that seem overwhelmingly large and insurmountable can be approached by looking at the simplicity of the issue to specify a step to take for progress. Let me give you a brief example. Terry Fox started the Marathon of Hope. It's a cross-Canada run of 3,339 miles. Since he had an artificial leg, his running style was a shuffle and a hop. He managed about 24 miles a day and completed the run in 143 days. He was asked how he kept himself going when he was exhausted and knew he had thousands of miles ahead. His response, I just kept running to the next telephone pole. So, divide up your work. Focus on and complete one thing at a time. There's always something you can focus on. During my specialty training in psychiatry, one of my first-year supervisors had a really puzzling picture on the wall. It was a photograph in which everything seemed just really curiously out of focus. I met with him every week. I glanced at the photograph until finally, toward the end of the year, I asked him about it. He said, look carefully, Dave. What do you see? Well, I walked over to the photograph to get a closer look. Closer didn't help. It still seemed out of focus. I saw no particular aesthetic value. My experience and considerable interest in photography didn't help. Steve, I said, the only thing I notice is that there's only one branch of one tree in focus in the entire picture. And he nodded. He said, that's why I have it hanging there. It's my reminder that while things may seem confusing and blurry, there's always at least one thing that you can have in focus and see clearly, which is why he was a great supervisor for first-year residents. 6, you're writing your own story. Be consistent in the pursuit of your goals. It takes 25 to 30 days to etch a new pathway in your brain to make it permanent. Remember the NASA astronauts. And that's just for simple stimulus and response behaviors. Others take longer, but the point is about consistency. 7, you're writing your own story. The benefit of doing more of what's working and less of what isn't working will become evident and self-perpetuating. Now, this is all really simple. Good parents have known this for centuries, but sometimes it just takes human science and cognitive research to remind us of the obvious. 8, you're writing your own story. Ask for feedback. 2, a spouse or partner, ask on a scale of 1 to 10, rate the quality of our relationship. 2, an employee or colleague, on a scale of 1 to 10, how am I doing? Then, how can I get to 10? A tribe in southern Africa called the Bemba has an interesting practice. When they hear a story of a person doing something wrong, something that destroys the social net of their tight community, all work in the village halts. The people gather around the offender and one by one recite all that that person has done right in his life. Good deeds, responsible behavior, thoughtful acts. This honest feedback on misbehavior has a time-honored consequence to allow the person to reclaim the better part of himself. He remembers who he is and why he is important to the life of the village. This may have been an original 360-degree feedback. Even without this kind of social network and feedback, we can relax and remember our way back into alignment with our true selves. We can get centered and reconnect with our essence. Guess who said this? It's not that I'm so smart. It's that I stay with problems longer. It was Albert Einstein. How to ask is a crucial factor. Ask clearly, confidently, and sincerely. Let me tell a brief story about this. Virginia Satir, the well-known family therapist, was hired by the Michigan State Department of Social Services to submit a proposal on how to restructure the Department of Social Services to better serve the client population. 60 days later, she provided the department with a 150-page report. They said two things. This is the most amazing report, and how do you come up with all these brilliant ideas? She said, I just ask all the social workers in your department what it would take for the system to work better. Now, you may have noticed that each of these AAA principles of change to author a new story begins the same way. You're writing your own story. That's the first 4 steps of the roadmap, condensed. Recognize, observe, assess, decide what to change, compressed into the shorthand of awareness and acceptance. The third A, the remaining three steps, just 12 action steps. 9, you're writing your own story. Get success insurance. There's a component of the workbook that I summarize the work that was led by Goldsmith, one of the leading and initial executive coaches in this country. He talked about and found 6 most important reasons people give up on goals. And, of course, in the inverse is success insurance. So look at those 6 most common reasons people give up on goals and incorporate addressing each of them. And there's some material in there about how to do that to create a success insurance. 10, you're writing your own story. Take a chance. A young chiropractor just out of professional school wanted to open a practice in Carmel, California. He was told he'd never make it. There's already one chiropractor for every 8 people in Carmel. He went to 12,500 homes and talked to 6,500 people. He asked 3 questions. Which location should I open my office, the north or west side of town? Should I have extra office hours from 7 to 9 or from 5 to 7 p.m.? And which newspaper should I advertise in? He added as he was leaving, when I have an open house party, would you like an invitation? In the first month, he took in $72,500, and in the first year, he netted over $1 million. And number 11, you're writing your own story. It's never too late to start. Don't let conventional wisdom or limiting assumptions ghostwrite your story. Cliff Beyond was a 61-year-old Australian sheep herder. He heard about a cross-country race from Sydney to Melbourne and decided to enter. He showed up in Oshkosh overalls and work boots. The officials looked at him like he was crazy. They said, this is a race of over 800 kilos. The most seasoned runners in the world compete. Do you have any running experience and equipment? He said, yeah, I run after my sheep every day, and I got these boots and this baseball cap. So when the race began, the world-class runners took off as they were trained to begin. Cliff started shuffling along in his boots. You're supposed to run 18 hours and sleep 6. But no one told Cliff this, so when the other runners were sleeping, he just kept shuffling along, and he shuffled along for days. He cut 5.5 hours off the world record. We each have beliefs that limit us. Find the story that will improve you and start believing that. If there were no barriers, what would your ideal belief be, your ideal life be? And finally, 12. You're writing your own story. Everything is okay in the end. If it's not okay, it's not the end. For tens of thousands of years, before books and computers, we transmitted our essence and our principles by story. Story linked to the past, organized the present, and illuminated the future. Story allowed us to connect with each other's humanity and the paths crossed on the long journeys out of Africa to populate the rest of the world. Then the anatomy and physiology of our brains grew by putting thoughts and feelings into stories. Stories informed, instructed, inspired, governed, organized. Story is the most powerful way humans communicate. Stories give birth to possibility. Stories are a way that we resonate with our earlier selves, connect with others, and create a roadmap to proceed. Your story is yourself, your life, and what will survive you. At some point in the distant future, all that will be left of you, all that will survive you, is your story. Be sure to get it right. Now, we've talked throughout about step 7, so I just want to highlight and review a couple of things that we've talked about. Step 7 is program new identity to incorporate and sustain the changes. Remember, we've talked about how this is something we're doing throughout our work with someone to look at helping them evolve a way of understanding the changes they're making, understanding the model that they need to evolve in order to make the change permanent, not just the behavior they're engaging in, but it changes how and who they see themselves to be. The model that they're operating on is evolving along with the story. So the things that I'm not going to go over here, but they're going to be condensed and well, not really condensed. They're going to be really spelled out in a chapter in the book that I'm going to send you, Outsmart Your Brain, an instruction manual on visualization, because for some clients this can be really helpful. So there's more of a detail in the chapter called The Old Art, New Science of Visualization. There's a chapter there that really expands on kind of the art and science of the vision and the art and science of affirmation, because the affirmation is the story that supports the vision. The vision is about rewiring your brain. The affirmation is about revising the software that has to do with supporting that vision. So What evasion does is to create tension or dissonance in your brain, because whenever you envision something, it stimulates the same pathways that actually seeing something does. Your brain can't tell the difference. So when you create a vision, a scenario of a successful completion, this vision will create dissonance between where you are now and the successful completion that you've envisioned. So this dissonance will give you creative ideas. It'll be a perceptual shift, a way to help you see things you haven't seen before, new possibilities. It's like coding your radar and your mind, and then once you code your radar for new possibilities, you begin to see things that fit with that. It also can provide motivation to take action. So the practical question, how long do you do this? Well, until the goal is reached. How many goals should you generate affirmation for? A reasonable amount, at least 6, maybe more, that you're working on daily. In this way, you create the feeling of internal success. You inhabit the experience. You create a future memory to live into. An affirmation will initially probably make you feel uncomfortable, even anxious. With an affirmation that's positive and not yet achieved, you're challenging the core belief of your identity, of who you are. You are each alchemist. Alchemists are people who believe in potential, in transformative power. And remember the most important lesson from everything I've said during our time together today. Just keep going to the next telephone pole. So, are there aspects of this that would be helpful for us to talk further about? I know that there's more material in the curriculum, and I'm going to send you more about this final step, but we've been touching on it really systematically about how this is a part of every step about addressing change and how someone sees and conceptualizes their new story and the model that they're operating on in a different way. So I didn't want to belabor that, but just I believe that this is the most important step that we have in helping someone create change, is to really look at how they're understanding that, conceptualizing it, and revising the model of who they are, which is to say the bedrock of their identity. And the most, again, the most common mistake that we often make in coaching is to add a new pattern onto the ones that already exist. But I think the most effective way is to perturbate that system, to look at changing that system and creating a different way of responding, and then looking at and revising the model based on that experience, because it's going to be a model most likely of effectiveness and mastery in a new way. Thoughts or questions that come up about this? I know this is a lot, but this is, you know, finally bringing together all 7 steps, and I want to be sure that they make sense and that you have a sense of how to use them so that you can organize what you're hearing and how you're putting it together in this way to see if it works for you, to see if you think it's something that you want to add to your repertoire. And that's why the looking at a case in this way, I think, can really help you see if it's going to add a dimension or dimensions to what you do, or add a perspective. Thoughts or questions?
Hi, David, it's Terry Finney. I really like the part about they have to be willing to pay the price for success, and that piece about people who love what they're doing and are committed to the purpose and the meaning are just so much more successful. That's kind of one of the things that's really key in my practice.
Yeah, to know your why.
Yep.
Because that creates an internal purpose.
Yep.
That is going to be so powerful. Yeah, thanks. Other thoughts or questions?
This was really great, Dave. I think you are, quite frankly, the next Paul Harvey. You have such a great way of really driving home each of these points, and I just really, I enjoy it, and I'm hoping I'm absorbing like a tenth of it because it's really powerful. And in terms of helping a client rewrite his or her story, I would like to, there's a couple areas I'd like to talk about, but one was already mentioned, and that was the intention, because that came up with this one client this morning. But the other is asking for feedback, and that stood out to me because one of the things that this gal struggles with is constantly looking externally for her support and affirmation that she's, you know, her validity, her success, and then I tried to get her to, well, one of the goals I think for most of us is to find that internal validation. So how can I use it and yet still honor the main goal, which is to have her find that internally?
Well, I think one way that I might think about it from just what you're saying is to empathically resonate with her,
mm-hmm.
that at a time that it really seems in the foreground, you know, I hear the frustration that you have in having how you feel about yourself being defined by how someone else responds to you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, that's right.
And she's giving away her power. And
right.
That assumption, that's a belief that is absolutely guaranteed to create frustration. Because mm-hmm. let's look at what would happen if she could ideally determine that. If she could ideally determine how someone else would respond, and it would be the perfect response, exactly as orchestrated,
uh-huh.
what would it do? It would work for a little while, but never well enough for long enough, because soon enough she'd need to do it all over again. So she would be addicted to that.
Uh-huh.
And it's a particular kind of addiction. Any behavior that becomes a central organizer for what you do is an addiction. So she's addicted to a kind of codependency, but that's not for us to talk about in that way.
Mm-hmm.
But I think to really resonate with how vulnerable she must feel to have how she feels about herself be determined by somebody else's response. So
yeah.
What she needs to do, in other words, then, is to move her point of reference internally to become her own authority.
Mm-hmm, 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 mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
For average Joe Blow coaching client, they would be like, oh, yeah, eureka, you know. But I think for her, she's pretty evolved in this, and she's like, I know, I've known this. And then I feel, it's amazing, because I feel like, okay, shit, now she knows this. So it's not like a huge aha.
Uh-huh.
Now I need to take it to the next level.
Okay.
Does that make sense? Like, now that you know that, okay, good, now
okay.
What?
Exactly. So what's your next step once you know that?
Mm-hmm.
And if she focuses externally, that's not where her next step needs to be.
Right.
To keep her power and not give it away, because she's
right.
making herself vulnerable. So how can she create the affirmations herself to move that point of reference internally? So I suspect you're going to have a lot of coachable moments. And for her, I would particularly want to be able to interrupt her to the, you know, the first time she uses second person or uses some external point. I would want to interrupt her
mm-hmm.
and point out how she's moved away from herself as a point
mm-hmm.
of reference, or an assumption that she can actually determine how someone else responds to her. Maybe even talk a little bit about the principle of, you know, the circle of influence and the circle of concern. The circle of influence is all the things that we want to be able, circle of concern is all the things we want to be able to determine and have concern about, from the ozone level to how our partner responds. Our circle of influence is what we can actually determine, what we have the power to actually determine in writing our own story, and that ends at the level of our skin. So the other things, how somebody else responds in the just right way, if we look at giving that up and keeping our energy for ourselves, it can be immensely more satisfying and effective.
Mm-hmm.
So each of the little times that she moves to an external point of reference, well, you know, I should really be doing this. Now, should is an authority term, meaning that there's some external authority. So I challenge her on that. You know, how do you determine your shoulds? You know, once that's internal, it's going to feel very different for her. But there are so many subtle ways, and she sounds very bright, that she can subtly do this and maintain that system without it being perturbated. And she can inoculate herself against any perturbation by saying, well, yeah, I know that, you know?
Right. It's true. You're right. Yes. That is sort of what I'm running up against. Which is interesting because that's something I would
give everyone back to her as it occurs and challenge. I think you're incredibly bright, but you're inoculating yourself to how much you're giving your power away and making it make sense to you.
Yeah, it's
so
brilliant.
Can I ask a question about this case? This is Terry Finney. Like, what would be like one or two affirmations for her?
Let me send that chapter around because I'm going to send the book around as soon as I make the revisions. But let me send the chapter around, and it has a systematic way of going about affirmations.
Okay.
So let me send that if you think that might be helpful.
Thank you.
Okay.
And there's something that you would have, that you would offer the system of creating an affirmation, you would offer that up to the client and then have them, what?
I'll offer up anything I got to a client. I'll share everything I know. Sometimes I send the client the curriculum that you guys have.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll do anything I can to create some progress. I'm careful not to do things that will inoculate somebody with an intellectualization, but, use it as information, but then be sure that they're using it as information, not just to, you know, intellectually defend themselves.
Right. But in terms of affirmations, I've seen coaches create affirmations and offer them to the client, and then I've seen coaches offer a system to create an affirmation and then have the client make their own.
I choose B.
Yeah.
I'm not going to ghostwrite somebody's story for them. They should fire me if I do that.
Absolutely. Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you all very much. Great, great input. I appreciate it. Look forward to picking up with you next week.
Great. Thank you.
See ya.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Have a great week.